From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talked to actress and author Carol Baker. She spent years trying to break out of her sex kitten image. Also today, I speak with Paul Verhoeven, director of the hit movie RoboCop. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Viewpoints, the new album from trombonist Steve Turay. And television critic David Bianculli reports from Los Angeles, where the networks are previewing their fall season. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actress Carol Baker. She became a star in the 1950s, the era of the movie Love Goddess, which is how she was typed. Her 1956 film Baby Doll, based on a Tennessee Williams story, was condemned by the Legion of Decency because of its sizzling sexuality. Baker portrayed a thumb-sucking nymphette who unhinged co-stars Carl Malden and Eli Wallach with her teasing sexuality. She was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in Giant, in which she co-starred with James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor. Baker says she tried to shake her sex kitten image, but in 1964 she accepted a role in The Carpetbaggers, which again created quite a stir, this time because of her nude scene. In the late 60s, she left America, disgusted with Hollywood. She settled in Rome, where she resumed her film career. That experience is the basis of her novel, A Roman Tale. But in the last few years, Baker has returned to American screens in such films as Star 80 and Native Son. She co-stars with Jack Nicholson in the forthcoming film Ironweed. Carol Baker now lives in London. I asked her why she left Hollywood in the 1960s.
I was never an independent agent, as actors are today. I was always under contract. And I think I always resented that. I mean, you were considered like a studio product. And while they did, I must say, wonderful things for you by, you know, continuously sending out publicity and photographs everywhere and really building a star. On the other hand, once they built an image for you, then they expected you to stay within that image. And that was very difficult for me to take. I was always rebelling against it. And that meant really hitting my head up against a stone wall, because if you rebelled, it only meant that you were on suspension, you couldn't work for anybody else, and you had no money.
The friction that you had with the studios, what kind of roles did they want to cast you in?
Well, obviously, something like The Carpetbaggers made an enormous amount of money. And yes, I did do for them Sylvia, and I did do Harlow, but I didn't want to continue just to do those type of roles, because I felt capable of doing other things as well.
But they didn't want to cast you in other roles.
No, because those were, after all, if they spend so much money building you up in this kind of an image, then that's the product they want to sell to the public that they know the public will buy.
When you got started as an actress, did you ever think that you were going to be cast in the love goddess type roles?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. As a matter of fact, it was interesting because I didn't even see myself like that after Baby Doll. I didn't believe this publicity. I always thought of myself as a very simple girl.
So you were really insecure about that?
Well, yes, because I felt that this was something that I was acting, that's what it was.
Are there gestures that you learned to use on screen to project sexuality?
I'm trying to think. I suppose, you know, a kind of a relax, like I used in both Harlow and The Carpetbaggers, a kind of a very relaxed, almost being slightly tipsy at times, and a very, you know, just allowing sort of the tension to leave your shoulders and so forth. And sometimes that's considered very sensual, because it's true, you're not tense with all the events of the day, but you're just sort of relaxed into your own body.
I'm thinking, too, you know, in some movies and in still photographs, you have an actress, you know, licking her lips or sucking her finger, something like that. And these are considered very sexy things. And it seems to me, maybe I'm hanging out in the wrong places, but these are gestures you only see, you know, in the movies and on the pictures. Yeah.
Those things actually come from sort of, you know, the sleazy magazines and so forth, where men say, gee, yeah, you know, that could be very suggestive of something else, and so you do that. And it's a way of bringing across a sexual point without actually seeing the woman experiencing anything real. So it's just kind of like a symbol of something that might be.
Can I ask you, this? I'm sure you get asked this a lot. Maybe it's a really stupid question, but does it turn you on when you do sex scenes in the movies?
Well, I guess the thing is that you must turn yourself on, because after all, if you're supposed to be, you know, overwhelmed by this guy, well, then you just like you have to act anything. If you have to be angry, you're not necessarily angry that day, but you have to think about something that makes you angry so that the emotion that you're showing comes from something real. Well, you have to do the same thing with love scenes. You have to get yourself in the mood for it. Now, sometimes it's painfully difficult because you could not in any way ever imagine yourself with this guy that you now have to kiss and be passionate about. It's really difficult. It's interesting, that thing about how you can imagine yourself with one person and not another, because he might be a perfectly not only nice guy, but he might be somebody that other women find yummy indeed, but you just don't happen to. The chemistry isn't there. So in those situations, it's very difficult. On the other hand, you find yourself in situations where you say, oh, be a little bit careful, you know, remember which is acting and which is the reality.
Do actors and actresses get very horny after passionate scenes are filmed?
I think a lot of them do. I was taught a great lesson by Clark Gable. I did But Not For Me with him. And I was totally besought by him because as a young girl, he was my sex symbol, and I just thought he was the greatest. And that low voice that he had, I remember some film where he spoke to a woman on the telephone, and I mean, it just sent me into raptures. So even though he was really getting on in years, and But Not For Me was like the third to the last film Clark Gable ever made, still, when I did this love scene with him and when he kissed me for the first time, and, you know, it was like everything I dreamed of, fantasized about as a child, that sort of way he had of holding the woman in a slight back bend kiss and then this deep voice as he talked, well, I mean, I went limp and they had to help me off the set. Really, they did. So he was wonderful because he treated me like a young woman that he had great respect for, but that he cared a lot about, you see. And so he took me aside and he said, now listen, honey. Oh, God, I could have fainted again. He said, now listen, honey. He said, you know, you're a young woman. You're a wonderful actress. But he said, I want to now give you a piece of advice that I think is going to help you all throughout your career and save you in your personal life. He said, look, you know, when you're out there on the set and you're doing a love scene, of course you have to do it completely convincingly. You just have to pour everything into it. But he said, the second that that scene is over, don't linger on it. Take a walk around the lot, take a drive, go make a phone call, go have a cup of coffee. Because he said, and then you will save yourself a lot of heartache and a lot of romances that should never have been. A lot of course, you know, a lot of leading actors get involved with one another. And he said, but it's the characters that are falling in love. He said, after all, you're playing with someone who's a character who's so brave and so noble or whatever. He said, you get this guy home and you find out, you know, he snores at night. He's a coward when it comes to cutting his finger or something like that. So he said, so just remember that when you throw yourself into this and your imagination and so forth, and you feel like you're falling in love, stop and think, well, isn't it the characters really that are falling in love? And it isn't really him and me.
Have you taken that advice?
Oh, yeah. I never was involved in one, with one of my leading men.
Actress Carol Baker is my guest, and she is now a novelist as well as an actress, and her novel is titled A Roman Tale. It's just been published in paperback. Marilyn Monroe wanted the role that you got in Baby Doll, mm-hmm. right? And you'd met her several times.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And from the impression I got from your autobiography was that you had two feelings toward her. One was of this sense of competition, like stay out of my roles and stay away from my husband. Could you commiserate about it, or was there too much competition to actually sit down and share the kinds of common joys and problems that
yeah,
you had?
Yeah, you know, the competition, I've always found this in Hollywood, that the competition was so fierce that you really, I mean, it was so difficult to have friends. It was almost, you know, impossible. And you were so insecure about your position and the other person was so insecure about their position, and you were always afraid you might give something away. And this is one of the things that fascinated me almost from the first moment when I went to Europe. One of the things that impressed me so greatly was the difference that you could have in relationships with women there, how women appreciated one another. Oh, yes, okay, at times they could be competitive and bitchy and so, but they weren't afraid of one another. They liked to talk to each other. And also the fact that they were in a society that I had only seen, and in a position that I had only known of men being in before. Because the men in Hollywood, it was a very chauvinistic place, and they really ran everything, and they were the strong arm of everything, you know. And you were the woman, you had to just try to, you know, chisel your place in there somewhere, but they controlled it all. And in European filmmaking and in the European society, I found suddenly that it was the women who really had the power. And they did what they wanted, and they did what they wanted with the guys. They controlled it. They controlled it all. Sometimes not necessarily by being honest with the men, but they would then love to get together and say, gee, you know, and it reminded me of what a locker room of men might be like, saying, gee, you know, him and or her and what she does. And so, and they did this with men. And they would tell you who were the good lovers, and they would tell you, well, if you want to be on this producer's good side, well, you tell him you like that last picture of his. We all know it stank, but anyway, you tell. And, you know, it was a kind of a conspiracy of women. And not only, but the extraordinary thing was that I found most of them were, I mean, I'm not all that tall, I'm 5'5", but most of them were, to me, they were Amazons. They were so big and, you know, tall and voluptuous and so forth. And yet, they were completely in charge, and they had enough confidence in themselves that they could be friendly with other women. And they didn't mind four or five famous, beautiful women sitting at a table together. They could enjoy one another's company without looking around and saying, oh, but maybe she's dressed better than I am today, or maybe she's a little more successful at the time. So if I'm seen with her, people are going to be reminded that I'm. And those are all the things that would have gone through your mind if you were sitting in the same company in Hollywood.
Have things changed in Hollywood now? Do you find it easier to be close to other women actresses?
Well, I know that things have changed a great deal, but that I'm not sure about. I still don't think there's that same kind of freedom that there is, you know, to really commiserate with your other females. I don't know that that freedom is here yet.
In your autobiography, you wrote that shooting The Carpetbaggers coincided with a period in your life where you had lost interest
in
sex,
yeah,
and that you weren't getting along with your husband very well at the time.
Yeah.
And you weren't enjoying a sexual relationship then. Did it make you feel like a fraud when you were on screen being
No,
sexy?
Because somehow in that when I felt like a fraud was when people would say, oh, she's so sensuous and so forth. And I felt like saying, but no, but that's not true. I'm a human being and I can go in and out of moods and so forth like anybody else. But on the screen, no, because obviously those feelings were still there, even though they were submerged. And there I was safe to release them.
My guest is actress Carol Baker, whose movies include Baby Doll, Giant, Star 80, and the forthcoming Ironweed. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Carol Baker is my guest, and she's written a novel. It's titled A Roman Tale. You had a couple of nervous breakdowns in an earlier part of your career.
It was toward the end of the Hollywood days, yeah.
Do you know what triggered them? I mean, can you say with sureness?
Well, I think it was probably a whole series of events. When I think of it now, I think of just my whole world falling apart, because after all, if all you are is a wife, a mother, and a product of a studio, and you're in a lawsuit with the studio, and you never see your children so that you've lost contact and you can't really call yourself a mother anymore, and your marriage is breaking up, then you're nothing. Then where are you in all of this? Because you're just a nothing. So I think really that explains it best. And I just simply had to get away, and I had to find out where I was and who I was.
Did you emerge stronger from the process of doing that?
Well, I don't know. It took me a very long time. And I, even though many years have passed, I still watch myself rather carefully when I get under a lot of stress, because I'm not sure whether I could snap again or not, because I didn't know the first time when it hit me, and I didn't, and even having experienced it once, the second one came upon me so fast I didn't know. Because I just, you know, when I suddenly felt that I couldn't take it anymore, boom, I just leapt out of it.
Did they have to do with your leaving Hollywood?
I left afterwards. Yeah, I left afterwards because I said I've got to get away. I've got to find a way to go on in life, to find some meaning to life. It all seems so meaningless at the moment.
Why did you settle in Rome?
That was an interesting thing because it wasn't something that I'd planned. Although I had said to Marilyn Monroe after she'd been fired by Fox, since we were talking about Marilyn, and I just knew that her career was everything to her. She really didn't have anything else. And I also knew that she was blackballed and that she wouldn't work for many years to come, and she knew it too. I mean, for me, I think that was the cause of everything. You know, I think that's the reason that Marilyn is dead, because she couldn't cope with the fact that 20th Century Fox had fired her and now she could no longer work for anybody and she would no longer be Marilyn Monroe after a few years passed. But I said to her, feeling this very strongly, I said to her, but Marilyn, why don't you go to Europe? I mean, if all you can see is this tiny little community here, but surely the world is bigger than that. And other countries make movies. And why don't you go somewhere else? They'll adore you. They'll throw flowers at your feet. And she said to me, I can't, Carol. I'm alone, and I don't have the courage to go alone. So I suppose that when a similar thing happened to me, I kind of in the back of my mind remembered having said that. Gee, you know, there is a whole world out there, you know. So what difference does it make if you're happy, if you're living in India or in China on a rice paddy? You know, what difference does it make? So the Italians came along and offered me to be a special guest of theirs at the Venice Film Festival. And somehow something struck a chord, and I knew that that was right for me. And I managed to get the courage together and to go. And it was true. I mean, it was like the moment I stepped off the plane, I suddenly reverted back to some person that I knew from long ago. And cloud lifted off of me.
You worked in a lot of Italian movies.
Mm-hmm. My first one I got almost immediately. I mean, I was in Venice 2 days when I was offered my first Italian film. That's what I needed.
They offered to you on the basis of your work in America?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Did you speak Italian?
No.
How did you work in Italian movies without speaking Italian?
Oh, that's very easy, because they don't do direct sound, and everything is dubbed afterwards. So I would dub myself in the English versions, and they would have an Italian actress do me in Italian.
What kind of movies did you do during the Italian period?
Basically, it was always the same movie. Well, because if you think of the way I look, I couldn't very well play an Italian. And also, I mean, I was to them a famous blonde American. So what they did is they would create stories for me. Well, the story was that this wealthy American woman, and of course she had to be wealthy, otherwise she couldn't wear beautiful clothes and have a beautiful villa and make the picture look luscious. So this very wealthy American woman comes to Rome for one reason or another. She's the death of her son has upset her, or her marriage has broken out, or whatever reason. She comes to Rome to recuperate, and she buys this beautiful or rents this beautiful villa, and then something happens. In one picture, a group of hippies invaded the villa and turned my life upside down. In another, I found a wonderful Italian that I fell in love with, and he turned out to be deceitful, and he had killed his wife, and he blamed it on me. Well, you know. But at any rate, they were all basically, that's kind of a story.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
When you started making American movies again, did you pursue the directors, or did they pursue you?
It just kind of happened. You see, all you have to do is sort of be around, and I don't know, you go to some event and your photograph appears in a newspaper, or you do a talk show or whatever, but you just have to remind them that you're still around, so you have to spend more time here.
The roles that you've had in the last two movies of yours that I've seen, Star 80, in which you play the mother of the Playboy centerfold, mm-hmm. and Native Son, in which you play a blind, wealthy woman who's the mother of one of the leading characters, mm-hmm. They're mother roles. They're older women roles. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely different kind of role than the American movies you were making
yes.
when you mm-hmm. had left, right before you left yeah. America. And I think it's just a really interesting leap. You know, it's an interesting change.
Oh, thank you. Well, that it wasn't easy to get them to believe in me for those parts. As a matter of fact, I could have been working in America much sooner had I, accepted a role on a soap opera, because they did immediately say, oh, Carol Baker's back, gee. She'd be great in these glamorous parts. But that, I had done all of that, and I just really wasn't interested in working anymore if that's all I could do. So now, from those smaller roles, then suddenly I was cast as John Forsythe's wife in a TV movie, and now I'm playing Jack Nicholson's wife in a very serious film. And so it's wonderful. I mean, it was hard to convince people that that's the way I wanted to be used and I should be used. But yeah, I do think it's more interesting, and I'm very happy that it's finally, you know, come about.
You know what? I guess you probably escaped. One of the many things you probably escaped by leaving America when you did was this image of, oh, the aging sex star or the aging beauty queen or whatever, what, oh, her career is going to like dissipate now that she's getting wrinkles or she's getting older. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can act in parts that aren't related to that, it just doesn't matter. You can relax and be yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure that's a terrible strain for someone who is on a soap opera and week after week looks gorgeous and yet knows, because at a certain age, I mean, over 50, you know, things deteriorate pretty fast. So it must be a terrible worry.
Well, yeah. I hope you don't mind my saying this, but I just think you're sitting here, you're not wearing any makeup, and I don't think you are.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not a lot of makeup. But you look so attractive to me. I mean, you have so much character and such an interesting face, and I just think it's great because, I mean, you're dressed really, you know, it's a nice dress, but it's pretty casual, really. Mm. You know, I don't know.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's true. At a certain moment, because I find this too, I find with people, actors and actresses that I've known for a long time, I find that there's a kind of a depth that comes through.
That's the word
a bit
I was looking for.
On.
Yeah,
and maybe it's because when you're very young and there are no character marks on your face, it's just like a round, you know, pumpkin or a piece of fruit or something, and there's absolutely no telltale lines at all. Maybe it's a little too difficult at that time to read people, because I often think that very young people aren't appreciated so much for the acting that they do, because all you can see is the beauty, you know, and it's like the smoothness of their skin, that everything also, you know, that it just flows away, all that they're feeling and so forth, and that it shows up later. Yeah, most people I find are more interesting a little later on.
So are you not concerned at all about getting older?
Of course I am.
Oh.
Who wouldn't be? No, I think that it's shocking. I mean, didn't you feel at a certain point in your life that you would never grow up fast enough, and you said to yourself, oh, I can't stand this. I'm so young. I'm younger than anybody else. I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't make my own decisions. And then a little later on, you reach about 20. I remember how old I thought I was at 30. I said, okay, next month is my 30th birthday. I'm going to get serious. It's time for me to wear girdles. It's time for me to pull my hair back, because I'm going to look ridiculous, you know. And then the more time passes and you say to yourself, oh, my God, wasn't I stupid? I wish I was 30 now, because that's so young. But at a certain stage, yes, I must say, you say to yourself, well, I really do see the signs of age, because it doesn't all happen at once. And I do see the signs of age, and it is a bit frightening, because I thought it would happen to everybody else, but I never thought it would happen to me.
Are the people who were in power when you left Hollywood still making movies now?
No.
Do you have to confront them at all? Do they have any control over the roles you get anymore?
No. No.
So that's all over.
Gone. Yeah. I think also I had to wait till most of them died off before I dared to come back to Hollywood. Really. I think there still would have been opposition to me.
Do you ever ask yourself what your life would have been like and what your career would have been like had you just stayed?
Had I stayed? Yeah, but then I would have been a different human being. I sometimes say, gee, isn't it a pity that I wasn't made of sterner stuff, that I had to be so sensitive about everything? And then now I look back on it and I say, well, if I had a chance to do it all over again, what would I do? And I realize I'd do exactly the same thing, so things would work out exactly the same way.
Carol Baker, I want to thank you very much for visiting with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been actress Carol Baker, whose movies include Baby Doll, Giant, Star 80, and the forthcoming adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Ironweed. Her latest book is the novel A Roman Tale. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Junius Irving Scales, who's written a memoir about his imprisonment during the McCarthy era, so I hope you can join us. Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Dutch film director Paul Verhoeven talks about his first American film, the science fiction thriller RoboCop. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the first album from trombonist Steve Turay, who, among other things, plays in the Saturday Night Live band. And television critic David Bianculli calls in from California, where he's getting a preview of the network's fall lineups. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Trombonist and arranger Steve Turay has spent most of his professional career playing as a sideman in jazz, Latin, and studio bands. Turay has just stepped forward to record his debut album as a leader. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has this review.
That's trombonist Steve Turay playing J.J. Johnson's composition Lament. It's from Viewpoint, Turay's new album on Stash Records. J.J. Johnson first recorded Lament in 1954, but it didn't become a jazz standard until Miles Davis recorded it with Gil Evans 3 years later. Lament is usually taken at a dolorous tempo in keeping with its title. The decision to speed it up is an example of the fresh thinking that Steve Turay brings to Viewpoint. Remarkably, this is his first album as a leader. Although he's still in his mid-30s, he's extremely well-seasoned. He's worked with an impressive list of band leaders, including Art Blakey, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, Woody Shaw, and Lester Bowie. He's also played with Latin bands, and he's put in a share of time with studio orchestras. In fact, if you look for him, you can see him each week in the band on Saturday Night Live. If this were the 1950s, when there were lots of nightclubs and small jazz labels, a musician with Turay's credentials wouldn't have had to wait so long to make his first album. On the other hand, because he had to wait so long, he brings a certain ripeness to his first date. To be frank about it, just a few years ago, Turay was a glib and humdrum soloist with a fleet, poker-faced trombone style modeled on J.J. Johnson's. More recently, Turay has realized the horn's vocal and comic potential. It sounds as though he's been listening carefully to Vic Dickinson, Dickie Wells, and Tricky Sam Nanton, trombonists who spoke through their horns and who performed sleight-of-hand tricks with plungers and mutes. Turay has also blossomed as an arranger. Here's evidence of that, a bittersweet version of Duke Ellington's In a Sentimental Mood, with tongue-in-cheek solos by Turay and trumpeter John Faddis, and some heavenly scored passages for trumpet, trombone, and cello. Yeah. Duke Ellington's In a Sentimental Mood, performed by trombonist Steve Turay from his new album Viewpoint. Turay shows off his versatility on Viewpoint. In The Bargain, he offers a kind of sampler of jazz history. There's only one false touch, a tribute to Kid Ory and the New Orleans Parade Bands that borders on mockery despite its affection. But the pluses far outweigh that one minus. In addition to the sprinting bop and modal numbers that one might expect from a former member of Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, there's a dazzling salsa piece and an energetic semi-freeform piece. There's also a version of Miles Davis's All Blues. On it, Turay plays conch shells. He blows into the shells with what sounds like the same embouchure he uses for trombone. The result is delightfully exotic. Viewpoint is an impressive debut, all the more gratifying for being slightly overdue.
Jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Dutch film director Paul Verhoeven. His new film, RoboCop, is one of the big hits of the summer. It's his first American film. His previous films include The Fourth Man and Soldier of Orange. RoboCop is set in the future in crime-ridden Detroit. It stars Peter Weller as Murphy, a cop who is brutally murdered by a gang of crazed drug dealers. His dead body is refashioned into a new kind of law enforcer that is half man and half machine, called RoboCop. RoboCop is designed by a ruthless corporation called OCP, which controls the police force and is trying to take over the whole city. Paul Verhoeven grew up in Europe following World War II and recalls watching a lot of action movies. His new action film is filled with shootings, car chases, and firebombings. He told me that seeing a lot of American movies as a young boy left a strong impression on him.
I was educated with American action pictures, and I loved that as a child, and I think you never forget things like that. And it's somewhere in my mind. And having the chance to do it now as an adult, I think I like that very much.
When you were shown the script for RoboCop, did you see things in the script that made you realize that the movie could be more interesting than just a run-of-the-mill genre film?
When I started to study the script in a serious way, I was really immediately then aware of the different layers, levels, or whatever you want to call that, that for me made the film more than an action picture.
What were some of the things, some of the layers that made it more than an action picture to you?
Well, the two important things for me were the fact that there was this situation, kind of what I would call kind of a religious situation of a man who loses his soul and his body and is then resurrected into another body, into the body of a robot. But there is still something of his past or his human characteristics are still there, and he starts to memorize them. And the other layer, of course, is the corporate level of what in the film is called the OCP organization, which has taken over the police force and things like that, and is a kind of a metaphor, of course, for modern government, I think. These were the two things that attracted me immensely and made me think that I could do an action picture like RoboCop. I think without these elements, I would have refused to do it. I would have been even not able to do it.
You had to choreograph a lot of action and violence for the movie. The most gripping death sequence is when the cop, Murphy, is killed. He's the cop who becomes the RoboCop later on in the movie.
Right.
And I wonder where you got your image of what it would be like to be tortured and then shot to death slowly by these thugs. Does your image of that come from other movies? Have you been exposed to violence of that, or is it just fantasies that you had that you were drawing on?
Well, it's certainly it has not happened to me, of course, but I grew up, when I was a child, I grew up in Holland, and we were occupied by the Germans at that time. Our houses and the neighborhood was bombed continuously. There were always people dead on the streets. I mean, it was a very violent youth. And I think memories of that are slipping into my movies, not only in this one, I suppose also in the other ones. And the violence and the cruelty is something that I think is, I call it hell, but it's something that happens on Earth, of course. And I think I give a kind of a feeling there of what human beings can do to each other and regularly are doing to each other.
You know, one New York film critic, a film critic from The Village Voice, wrote, in describing the violence in your movie, he wrote, "I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry about how much I enjoyed every brutal, perverse minute of it." And I wonder if you've gotten that reaction from a lot of people, that they really enjoyed your movie, but they felt ambivalent enjoying the violent scenes.
Well, it was the first reaction I got from my wife when she saw the picture. And she was the one who, in fact, pushed me in the first place to do the picture. But when she saw the picture, she said to me, well, and of course, I think she likes me very much. She said, "It's so strange seeing this picture. I'm really amazed about myself that I enjoyed that violence and the ending of the picture that much. And I don't understand that really, because she's a really non-violent person." And she said that there was something in the picture that seduced her to accept the violence and to like the violence. And it's certainly, this ambivalence is certainly there. And it might be something with my character. I know there is, I think, in my character something like a fascination for violence, which has no moral implication at all. It's certainly a kind of an amoral feeling. And on the other hand, there is this kind of fear for violence. And I think both are there at the same moment. And there is no synthetic solution that I brought into the picture. And certainly there is no synthetic solution that I have for these things in my life. I think it's something we can't solve, that both things are there, the attraction and the repulsion.
Peter Weller, who's the actor that plays the main character in the movie, spends most of the movie in a steel robot costume, and that also has a steel hood. So during much of the movie, the only part you see of Peter Weller's body is his lips coming through that steel helmet. Why was it important to have a good actor in that costume, someone who would be, for the most part, invisible? You could have, you know, tried a stuntman for those sequences.
Yes, you could have tried, but I have tested about 70 or perhaps 100 actors with interviews or with videotapes for that part. And the problem is, and that's why you need a good actor, it's extremely difficult to make convincing movements as a robot. It easily looks very silly. And I think acting, which is partly physical acting, and it's not even mime acting, it's just body movement, and I think body movement is part of acting. And I think film, of course, is still for me a visual art, and the words are important, but the words are more important for characters. Psychological characters than for a more symbolic character as RoboCop is.
You're living in Los Angeles now. Do you plan to stay in America and make more American movies?
Absolutely.
Why would you like to stay here and do American films?
Well, I got the feeling during this 1.5 year that I worked on RoboCop that there were so many talented people around, and in fact there are talented people in my country and they are all over the world, of course, but there is so much diversity of talent here. I think because the United States is a country where people from so many different sides of the world came together that you find, for your actors for example, you find so many different faces, characters, psychological backgrounds, everything, that the choice is really wonderful. And then on the technical field, I think the Hollywood film industry is the most advanced of the world. So for somebody who wants to make pictures, it's a real ideal place. And then secondly, and I think that's even more important, what's happening in the United States, especially on whatever field, if it's on the religious field like with Tammy Baker and Jim Baker, or on the political field with Oliver North or the other things that happened the last half year, I think it's such a fascinating country where, because it's still very democratic, a lot of things come to the surface that are hidden in other countries. And as a artist, as somebody who's interested in drama, it's a fascinating world. And it's really more inspiring to be here than to be in Europe at this moment. That's my feeling.
What kind of movies would you like to do in the future?
I would love to do a comedy.
Well, don't you think RoboCop is a comedy? I do.
It partly is, yes. But a complete comedy, where the accent is more a little bit more on the actors, where the characters and the psychological backgrounds are more important, where there's a little bit more dialogue, and without any special effect.
Paul Verhoeven, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Verhoeven is the director of RoboCop. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up for today's show?
We have a report from Panama, where there's a general strike, and also where there's apparently been an attack on the home of the military officer who has charged that Panamanian strongman Noriega came to power by virtue of political murders and assassination. Also, a report on attacks against Salvadorans living in California. The attacks appear to be politically motivated.
Can you preview one of your feature stories?
I can preview one, which is about motorcycle riders, bikers in East Tennessee, who are turning to religion and who hope to clean up the image of bikers.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our TV critic David Bianculli is in Los Angeles, along with over 100 other television critics, attending a conference where all the networks, PBS, cable, and syndicators are previewing and promoting their fall season. The new shows are being screened on closed-circuit TV in the critics' hotel rooms, which means David's getting to spend a lot of time in his room. He's on the line with me, from his hotel room, of course. Hi, David.
Hi.
Sounds like the purpose of this conference is to prove that being a couch potato isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, it's sort of like an endurance test for us, too, especially since I don't know why these things happen in cycles, but when you watch a bunch of TV shows at once, there are recurring themes. And we've already seen two shows this year where young bachelors have basketball courts in their hotel rooms. I mean, and I don't know whether that's a big L.A. architectural theme that's gonna sweep the whole nation or not. But
why do they have you in your hotel rooms instead of watching in group screenings?
Oh, I think that's a calculated and very smart effort on the part of the networks to keep critics away from one another. Because when we're in large groups watching these things and they're bad, the giggles start to build and the laughter, and then the outright, it's sort of like vaudeville all over again, start throwing things at the screen and rubbing up against each other like locusts, and I think they're smarter to keep us in small groups or no groups.
I know the conference is still in its early stage, so it's premature for you to give us the lowdown on the whole new fall season, but what's on your menu for the next few days that you're looking forward to seeing?
Well, oddly enough, I can say that I'm looking forward to something from ABC this year. There's two shows, one by the producers of L.A. Law and another by the producers of Buffalo Bill. And they're two sitcoms, and one is Hooper Man, starring John Ritter, and the other is Slap Maxwell, starring Dabney Coleman. So when I get back from here, I'll let you know whether they lived up to my expectations or not.
Do you ever cut out on sessions that look so bad that they're not worth sitting through?
Oh, yeah. Oh, listen, I skipped out. There's like Tempo Television Network. Now, I don't even know where that is on cable or who can get it, but they have a press conference. Here's some of the stars. Nancy Zeman, host of the how-to program called Sewing with Nancy. Bird and animal caller Bill Harper, host of the series Outdoor with Bill Harper, and that sort of stuff. So you do slip away from some things and go do some other stuff.
While you're out in Los Angeles, are you getting to visit any television sets?
Well, we slipped out of something like Tempo, four or five of us, and we got on the new Star Trek set. That's a syndicated, all-new versions, all-new episodes of Star Trek with a new cast set 80 years in the future. And we got on it, which is a big TV deal for TV critics, and talked to the set people and some of the stars to find out whether it was just going to be another show or whether they really loved it. And the feeling over there is so good, this may indeed be the most enjoyable or interesting show of the year, and it won't be on any of the networks. It's syndicated.
Is the set very super in any way?
Oh, it's great.
It's great.
It occupies three whole sound stages, and I'd like to move in there. I mean, the living quarters are probably, I mean, we're talking high rent. They could probably sublet them in L.A. and make back their production costs.
So tell me, is this a critic's dream or a nightmare?
It's more nightmare than dream. I don't like being away from my family for this long, and it gets into sensory overload and gets into, like, almost like journalism by production line. It gets harder and harder as these tours get bigger to come up with individual stories. So it's a good test.
Okay, well, David, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Go back to watching some TV. Enjoy the rest of the conference. David Bianculli is Fresh Air's television critic and television critic for the New York Post. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with John and Marina Baer, co-authors of How to Repair Food. We'll get some tips on salvaging those kitchen disasters. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile singer Etta James, and book critic John Leonard will review Günter Grass's new novel, The Rat. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, research assistants from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.